Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
It is the ATS Mix Show, and of course, I am Johnny Anonymous, and on the line, on the other end, I've got...
I'm Dave Rabbit, here on the other end, John.
Well, you sound a little different, Dave. Are you in your studio?
Actually not, John. I'm actually in Saigon right now.
Really?
And I'm going to be in and out of the studio probably for the next 30 days. Just doing a mini tour of the country, going back through my steps as I kind of did my tours and started Radio First Termer. And I'm flying back and forth between the United States and Saigon. So
is this on the ATS Mix credit card?
Yes, it is. You know, the thing about it is, you know, I love it. You know, hi, my name is Dave Rabbit, and I carry the American.
When I go traveling, I carry the ATS Mix credit card with me.
Yeah, it's like the American Express, except this one, you know, that the Amigos pay for. So, you know, it's going to be a bitch a little bit because it's obviously inconvenient not being in my studio. But, you know, the show must go on, John, so I'm here available.
Absolutely. Is part of the slogan on the ATS Mix credit card, more mix, less tricks?
That's down the street.
I mean, since you're in Saigon?
Yeah, that's down the street.
Well, hopefully, maybe you'll even bump into, well, maybe that might have been the wrong term, but you'll run into a few friends from years past. Who knows?
I already have, you know. Already saw Madam Ho and, of course, you know, Bambi, my main squeeze, so, yeah.
Right. Well, okay. Well, you know, this is a big kind of an interesting week. Here you are, you're in Saigon, and I just came back from an investigative report in Monterey. In fact, if you haven't had a chance to, folks, there is an investigative report that is posted on the ATS Mix Arena that you can download of my going to Monterey and investigating a research group by the name of Project Firefly. And I spent 5 days, 4 nights up there, or down there, somewhere. I was there. Wherever I was at, it was called Monterey, California, and it really sucked, Dave.
Oh, it did not.
It did.
You're lying, dog. It didn't suck. It was a little bit, you know, what's a few variable clouds when you're sky watching, John?
My friend, those weren't clouds. That was a fire. They have...
That's right. Yeah, but
we've got over 1,100 fires right now in California.
But didn't you say Firefly started them?
No, it just happens to be a coincidence that their name is Project Firefly.
Anyway, it was a great trip for you, though, John.
Oh, yes. Thank you as we segue back onto track. It was fun. I had a great time meeting all those guys up there. I think there were 5 of them in total. And they do things very scientifically. As I said, I was disappointed that the skies and the fires weren't really agreeable with us, but they showed me some things. We reviewed a lot of past tapes. They had literally a box full of tapes that they had videotaped of their watching the skies, and they do things, as I said, very scientifically. They have a regiment that they follow, and I was very impressed by it, and so much so that when the skies clear up and they give me an email, I will be going back up there and trying to complete the investigative report that I tried to do this last weekend.
Right.
But anyway,
not to segue into something else, but I am going to segue into something else.
All right.
This is one hell of a show, is it not?
Yes, it is, as if not any of our shows haven't been a hell of a good show. But this one is, in particular, of course, we've got our UFO sightings reports.
I love that part of it. And then don't we also have part one of Colm Kelleher?
Colm Kelleher. In fact, he spells his name C-O-L-M Kelleher. And I believe a lot of people probably get his first name wrong.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, don't we take him to task over how he's got a weird spelling name?
Yes, we do. In fact,
okay, very good.
Yes, and as you listen to the show, as I mentioned, I was gone for a while, so you're going to hear me on the phone as we were doing both that segment, and so I don't come across very clear. So my apologies there. I apologize for that.
Are you, well, you came across clear when we were doing the show. What happened?
It didn't record that way.
I'm so sorry, John.
Yeah.
And then we let the skeptic unleash again. We unchain him. Unchain my heart.
Yes.
And I love this unchained skeptic, don't you?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, these past couple of skeptic overviews have been unchained and very interesting. Hey, listen, since we've only got about 40 seconds left, I want to remind everybody that MUFON, if you are in the San Jose area, is going to be featuring beginning July 25th, the Mutual UFO Network, which is the United States' largest and most respected UFO investigative organization, will be hosting some great experts that are going to include like Nick Pope, U.S. General Wilford D. Brower, retired from, in fact, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly. He's from the Belgium Air Force. They got a lot of people. John Greenwald, Victor Camacho, George Knapp, and much, much more. 10 seconds left here. What do you say?
The truth is out there, John. The truth is out there. Who we got coming up?
Oh, yes. You have time. You can leave a question for X-Files co-writer and executive producer Frank Spotnitz. Go to the ATS Mix guest area for more information.
Later.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From above topsecret.com.
Oh, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe with sightings from across Canada. British Columbia wins hands down, with Vernon, B.C. alone logging in 6 sightings in 3 days. The following 3 were submitted to UFOinc.com. On May 29th at 10:40 p.m. under clear skies, a witness reported standing outside to see if a light spotted previously would fly overhead again, and was rewarded with a similar recurrence. A bright white light flew over the observer's building at low altitude without making any sound, then proceeded east until it blinked out. This is the 3rd night in a row this orb has been spotted by the same witness traveling over a busy main street. Each night it reveals itself 20 minutes later than the last. The observer intends to continue monitoring the situation. The next night at 11 p.m., 3 witnesses in a boat were stargazing and saw a bright white light heading east over Okanagan Lake. It was larger and brighter than any satellite and was not flashing. The witnesses continued to mark its progress eastward, when it suddenly grew dimmer until it flashed red and disappeared. On May 31st, between 9:30 and 10 p.m., a hotel employee was chatting with several guests at the pool when all of a sudden a massive white orb appeared in full view for all 10 people present to witness. As they marveled at the sight, it began to fade, only to be replaced by a second similar orb, which caught the attention of several more people. The witness who submitted the report was relieved to know others had seen the same phenomenon and commented that something strange is happening in the skies of Vernon. Meanwhile, on May 30th at 1:30 in the morning in Montreal, Quebec, a witness was crossing the street at an intersection when a light in the sky caused the observer to look up. According to the reporter, at precisely that moment, a white-green light roughly the size of a full moon was floating in midair for 1 second, then flew up into the atmosphere and disappeared. The object's speed, movement, and color did not correspond to anything the witness had ever seen previously. And lastly, the observer who reported a sighting in Coteau du Lac, Quebec, has included photos taken May 30th at 1:30 a.m. of a second green circular object making shapes in the night sky. This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
These are the reported sightings over the United States.
This is David C. In Tennessee, a viewer observed a glowing silverish red object treetop high crossing the highway. It looked as if it had just entered the Earth's atmosphere. The glow looked similar to a NASA module that is red hot on the fringe of the craft, but shiny silver in the center during reentry. The object definitely had a fuselage because of the glowing blue flame that was emitted from the rear and clearly visible compared to the glowing area in the front. The shape was similar to a light bulb, but more teardropped in the front. It was actually similar to staring at a light bulb on its side. You could see the parameters of the outside, but the glow restricted the sharp outside edge of the craft, except in the rear. It was approximately 30 feet long and 8 feet high. The craft crossed the highway parallel to the ground from south to north and disappeared over the trees to the north. It made no noise, but the Bunsen burner-like blue flame flickered from the rear of the craft at the same pace as the approximately 30 miles per hour speed it was traveling. In Oregon, a viewer noticed a illuminated ring that appeared over the mountain on the Oregon side of a river. The object was completely silent as it floated above the treetops about a mile and a half away. The ring then started to pulsate and slow down until there were several lights that were rotating slowly in one direction and then spinning in the opposite direction. The viewer stated, "I watched for about a minute as the object floated about, staying in the general area that it first appeared. Next, I heard the sound of a helicopter approaching. The object then moved and disappeared behind the mountaintop, and the sound of the helicopter faded." This is David C., reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
Are you ready for a close encounter of the tinfoil kind and want to do some collaborative writing with some of the most intelligent people on planet Earth? Then go to our board home at AboveTopSecret.com and find tinwiki.org in the Conspiracy Theory Discussion Forum area. TinWiki is an online encyclopedia where members can create new pages and where every page can be edited by anyone reading the page and wanting to improve it. The TinWiki Encyclopedia is for a specific type of topics only, such as conspiracy theories, UFOs, ghosts, paranormal phenomena, mythological creatures, lost civilizations, and life on other planets, just to name a few. So join thousands of other ATS members in creating an encyclopedia of AboveTopSecret.com articles that will be viewed by millions of members and guests from around the world. And if you happen to see William Wonsack or Optimus, tell them Dave Rabbit sent you.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
And through technology, yes, it can be your friend sometimes. We are connected up with Dave Rabbit and also the skeptic overlord himself, Bill Irvin. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Wonderful. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, John. You've got to speak up a little bit. There's about 16-hour lag between you guys and me in Saigon.
Well, what the hell are you doing in Saigon?
Well, you know, you did that Monterey trip, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm in Saigon because I wanted to see how Bambi's doing after all these years.
Do we dare ask who the hell is Bambi?
The years have not been kind, John.
To you or to Bambi?
Well, to both of us, but really to her, you know. She's not near as perky as I remember, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have a feeling that she wasn't called Bambi because of any resemblance to a deer.
Yeah, the deer factor is done gone, trust me.
I'm curious, Dave-a-roo, would you have been the thumper to her Bambi?
I could have very... Well, back in those days, I really could have been the thumper.
Not anymore, though, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I got news for you, boys. There ain't enough Viagra in town. You know, if I ever have a four-hour erection, I'm going to Vegas, babe, you know?
Well, this is certainly an interesting way of starting this program out.
That's FCC. Go ahead.
All right. Well, Bill, tell us what's been happening to ATS this week that has garnered your attention.
Well, first, what garnered my attention is I had a chuckle when you said through the wonders of technology. I have not had much luck with technology this weekend.
And why
is that? Of course, things worked out. Well, you know, some people out there, and I think you'll be able to relate to this, will be able to relate to the story. Come Saturday morning, you know, I'm looking at my Mac and I'm saying, oh, well, you know, it's about time I apply the latest system upgrade. You know, that new Safari version 3 is supposed to be faster, and there, you know, there's some some additional performance enhancements in the upgrade to Safari 10.4.11 or whatever the new version was.
Right.
I haven't gone to the latest 10.5 yet. So, okay. So I get started. I download that. And I start running it. And several people will gasp when I describe what happened. I don't think Dave will, but I think, John, you will. As the progress bar was moving on the portion of the update when it's rewriting important system files,
yes,
we have a power failure.
Oh, no.
Oh, geez. I can relate to that, by the way.
And so when the power comes back up, of course, the computer doesn't start because the system is just, it's gone. It's screwed. It's totally toast. It's totally, yeah, it's in a bad way. Couldn't start up in what's called on the Mac is the single user mode, and that's where you essentially get a Unix prompt, and you get to try to figure out what's wrong with your system by command line. It wouldn't even start to that, and the conventional wisdom is if you can't get that, then it's time to reformat the hard drive, and you better hope your backup is in good shape.
Oh my goodness!
So, however, there's one thing that I've remembered. Incredible things about the Macintosh is they come with the full system software. I mean, a lot of PC owners out there know they get their Dells or their Gateways home, and you know, if they want a copy of their system files or their software, they have to make their own disks from what's on the hard drive. Correct?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. You don't get the disk. You don't get stuff, but you get the whole thing. You get a bootable DVD with your Mac. So I booted it up in that. And sure enough, the installer noticed that there was an existing system on my hard drive. And there's an option where it does its best to install the new system and rebuilds all of your preferences based on what it can find.
Right.
And because otherwise I'd have to reinstall everything, reinstall all my software.
Which is a pain in the buttocks.
It's a whole weekend for all the crap that I got in this computer.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, almost 8 hours later, it was successful, and it's as if nothing happened.
Oh, really? Well, good.
Yes. And wow. To the point where even all of the cookies and temporary internet files for Safari are still intact.
Wow.
For the web browser. Yeah, so just an amazing bit of life-saving option on the installer on the Mac software that not a lot of people know.
But it took 8 hours to do that, though, right?
Well worth it.
That wouldn't have been happening on a Bill Gates unit.
No, it certainly would not have.
Wow.
So anyway, and speaking of Bill Gates, he has stepped down as full-time chairman of Microsoft.
I mean, yeah, he retired, what, after 2 days? I mean, he's 2 days retired now, I guess, or three, right?
That's right. So that's nice. Yeah, you know, who knows? Microsoft may suddenly get get better. They may find that they have some deep down do-gooder feeling and fix everything, but we doubt that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I can see the tea time now with him and Warren Buffett. By the way, Bill, ever since you stepped down, God, Microsoft's gone up.
Golly.
So anyway, let's jump in. I have a few topics here that I want to toss out for discussion, and something else that is important that happened on, or didn't really happen on ATS this week, but it came to light today. But the first topic, which ended up being the most popular, most responded topic this week, was started by a member who's been on the site a long time. Oh, okay. I guess it is the UK bloke. I just suddenly realized what this guy's name meant, the UK bloke. I was going to try to pronounce it Theuk bloke. Theuk. Oh, it's the UK bloke. See, I anticipate these guys come up with weird acronyms for their names, and this one's rather obvious. That's, you know, you get thrown for a loop. He started this thread on the 27th, and the title is I've been on the site a long time, and now I have pictures. And yes, he does. I'll read quickly what he related. Monday before last, my ears started humming, and I just ignored it. But then my daughter, the biggest skeptic there is, said she could see an odd green light hovering over the river. And since he's in the UK, he's talking about the Thames River in Hampton.
Right.
I took a look at first thought it was a helicopter, but the sound was way off. Not the normal thudding, but deep bass buzzing sound. And the lights were wrong as well. The lights were green with very bright white light that was much brighter than I could look at. I grabbed my camera and snapped the following sequence before it shot off towards the south. The images are shaky as I had to put it on a one-second exposure, and it was dark. I wanted to capture the image in context with the surrounding for you guys to look at. These images were shot in RAW, and the full EXIF data is attached to each image. And yes, indeed, there are some rather interesting images, and it is unfortunate that he didn't have a tripod, or at least didn't set the camera down on the windowsill to alleviate the shaking, because of that. It makes it very difficult to try to determine what these lights are, but they do appear to be in a pattern that are very different than what you would expect for a helicopter. So it's a very interesting thread. Quite a number of replies. We're already into our 21st page of replies. And wow. Have you guys seen this?
I saw it before I left out of town. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and yeah. I have to admit, I have been out of town for the past 5 days myself, so I have not been able to catch up on everything yet.
That's right. You have no idea. Well, anyway, then this next one, our second most popular thread, this is just a general topic that we can toss out to some legendary Dave, Johnny, and Bill banter, let's say.
Yeah, in our legendary rapport precedes us. Go ahead, Bill.
There you go. Yeah, I can imagine. This one was started by member C.C. Benjamin, and it was posted to the, I believe it was first posted to the news forum, and since it wasn't actually that much of a current news, it got moved over to War on Terrorism. It's a rather interesting story from the Daily Express, a UK paper, and the title of the thread is Sniffer Dogs Offend Muslims.
Sniffer Dogs?
Sniffer dogs. Here's the snippet.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Police sniffer dogs trained to spot terrorists at railway stations may no longer come into contact with Muslim passengers after complaints that it is against the suspect's religion. And it goes on to indicate that apparently there is a Muslim offense to dogs because apparently they're considered dirty animals.
Is that in the Quran?
I'm not sure if it's in the Quran or if it's just, you know. Well, see, that's the point of the story, where as you read the story and you read the member replies, and again, this is another one that's 20 pages of replies that's all over the map. Some are, you know, rather classic off-topic posts that needed to be deleted because members got a little exuberant in their expression of distaste for people who are different than themselves. But what it turns out is it's really not clear whether that's in the Quran specifically for dogs. But, you know, they are considered unclean animals, and apparently that's enough. But it raises the question. I mean, we're seeing this more and more where, you know, the Muslims and, they have specific religious beliefs, but they anticipate the entire world as they spread out to non-Muslim countries to bend to their particular beliefs.
Yeah.
And now, that's rather... Yes, go ahead, Johnny, or Dave.
Well, I mean, my question was, Bill, and forgive me because I don't have computer access and have it for a couple of days now, but did this happen in the United States?
This was in the UK.
Oh, it was in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
Okay. Well, still, it still applies. I mean, you know, if you're in somebody else's country, who gives a rat's buttocks what they're offended about or not offended about? If you're in someone else's country, just like if we were in a Muslim country, we would have to, you know, follow their rules. And if we didn't, we would have to suffer the consequences. And you think they would not punish us if we broke any of their laws or didn't follow their restrictions or whatever? So, I mean, you know, to me, you know, them bitching about it, you know, is a crock, personally. I mean, that's my take on it.
Send those U2Us to Dave.
To Johnny at ATSMix.com.
Johnny, what's your take?
Well, you know, I'm kind of on the borderline here because, if I recall correctly, didn't a lot of Judeo-Christians pretty much through history kind of do the same thing where they would go in, storm into a country and say, hey, all your religions are false, you got to follow our religion, and then that kind of became the religion that, whether you wanted it to or not, that was the one you had to follow. And
wasn't that Pope Benedict that said that?
Yes.
He said all your prayers belong to us.
That's correct. Please send those euros courtesy of Bill Irvin.
ATS com. Go ahead, John.
It's interesting that the Muslims, because if I recall correctly, and Bill, you'll have to correct me on this, isn't the Muslim religion like the second most popular, if not the most popular religion in the world?
It's, I believe it is. I think it depends what numbers, whose numbers you count.
Right.
And that's where it is. But actually, you brought up a good point. The issues that you're talking about in respect to Christianity, some of the worst of it were what, 500-600 years ago?
Right.
Exactly.
And if you think about it, the Muslim religion is about 400 to 500 years younger than Christianity.
Right.
So from that point of view, it's essentially as a religion in its same point in its age and evolution as Christianity was 500 years ago. Think about that.
But I mean, you know, the point of the whole thread is that, you know, they're offended because there's dogs sniffing their crotch over there, and I mean, you know, or whatever, you know, sniffing them for drugs. I don't understand their objection, you know, Bill and Johnny, because with the terrorist activity that we have going on in the world, and I mean, my Lord, I saw on the internet before I left out of town that, you know, that Baghdad just had a suicide bomber, and that it was female. And that more and more female suicide bombers are now taking the place of the male ones because, you know, they don't suspect females as often as they suspect a male. Hello, of course we're going to have a dog sniff you if it's a matter of saving some of our own countrymen. I just don't understand the bitching about this. I really don't.
Well, there's lots of point. There's material for 3 or 4 shows right there on that rant.
What? It's Bambi, crotch sniffing dog. Sorry.
Well, I mean, you raise some excellent points, but if you rewind those points back to what's inspiring these suicide bombers and what's causing the terrorism, and really, there's always been terrorism in the world. It's always been there. And so it's not like this is a new fear that we all need to be worried about.
Right,
but
exactly.
But it's being presented to us as the most terrible thing that is standing in the way of society for moving forward.
Right.
And it's, you know, in one respect, you know, those dogs are there to give you the false sense of security.
I mean,
because the dogs are there, sure, okay, nobody's going to take a bomb because the dogs will find them out. But still, generally, whoever is a terrorist, and we know from past experience in the terrorist attacks that have been successful in the West, these guys are pretty smart, they do their research, and they hit us in ways we don't expect. And in fact, the real terrorists what we suspect are real terrorists, or what we know of those who have been trained to attempt to try to be real terrorists, they actually try not to stand out.
Right.
So they certainly wouldn't complain about this. They wouldn't be the ones complaining about this. They would do their best to not stand out and not call attention to themselves.
Fear sells.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it really does.
Used to be just sex.
Yeah, I love it when sex sells.
I knew you would.
But fear's another thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, for you now, it's fear of sex. Is that what it is?
Yeah, pretty much, babe. Yeah, Saigon prostitutes haven't gotten any better looking, trust me. What else you got, boss?
Okay, well, so here's another topic that became popular, and granted, the thread starter does not portray a fair level of sophistication on this topic, but a lot of people jump in, and we end up with a 17-page thread posted recently in the Political Ideology Forum by a member, Counterterrorist. And it's titled, and I think I only, you know, in order to spark a discussion on this, I only think I need to read the title. And I'm it's a toss-up as to which one of you two jump in first.
Well, since I jumped in on the first, I'll let Johnny go ahead and jump in.
The title of this thread is "The Only Hope for This Country is Democratic Socialism and Equal Distribution of Wealth."
Mm-hmm.
This is like this is, you know, far out there socialism concept of just getting rid of the all of the landowners and the wealthy and redistributing their wealth equally to the working class.
Ah. Well, I got news for you. Everybody that's listening to this show right now will be dead and buried for hundreds of years before anything happens that politicians say is going to happen. It ain't going to happen in our lifetime. Might as well forget it. Might as well just chalk it up. Dave said it'll never happen. Trust me. You know, I'm going on 60, and I'll be dead by the time they do what the Democrats have promised that they're going to do with, you know, universal health care. I will be dead before that ever passes. So, you know, the distribution of wealth, it's a joke. You know, it's a joke. Yeah. It's the same crap they feed us every 4 years, you know, trying to get people to vote, you know, trying to be the Messiah, trying to be the Pope Benedict, trying to be the guy that's going to run the show. You know, here he comes, whether it's Barack, whether it's McCain, you know, here they come. You know, they're all going to run and, you know, rah-rah behind this guy, you know, whether it be Barack or whether it be John McCain. And, you know, in the hopes that all this BS they're feeding the American public is going to happen. Trust me, baby puppies, it ain't gonna happen in your lifetime.
That was very good. However, that had nothing to do with the thread.
Yeah,
and I don't care. I just want to do a rant.
And very well done, too, my friend. A few
thank
golf
you,
claps
thank
there
you.
For you.
It was a actually, sidebar rant, Bill.
Yeah, the premise of this thread is going back to a reoccurring topic that generally the disenfranchised youth or other downtrodden workers, if we will, just get upset about. And they're essentially looking for a, you know, to liquidate the capitalist society and take the money in the banks and take all the evil corporations and liquidate their wealth and redistribute it to the populace. The basic really, you know, the basic socialist ideal. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful utopian thing to think about that people could all be on an equal footing. But in reality, I mean, a lot of us work pretty hard, college and a lot of time after that to get where we are. And it's, you know, there's a good number of people, even middle class, that have worked pretty hard to get where they are, that are not going to want people that have not worked at all, who have been bums their entire lives, to suddenly be on equal footing. It's just that is just as unfair go ahead, Johnny.
I was just going to say, and I myself personally, I kind of like the utopian concept, although I also, as a realist, know that it would not work in the real world, because on one hand, you, as you had were talking about, as far as you have a bum or somebody that is not necessarily moving forward in life as well as, say, a doctor. Well, now here is a doctor who's now going to be earning $140 a week, which would be the same as this gentleman over here who is not a doctor working in, say, the janitorial world.
There's no incentive to be a doctor.
Exactly. So then everybody would say, well, hell, you know, why should I be going to school for 7 years to become a brain surgeon when I can earn just as much pushing the broom in the medical supply room?
One counter argument to that is there will always be people who are idealistic enough to say, I will be a good doctor because I want to be a good doctor. And that's great. Yes, there will always
be people. God bless those people.
Fantastic. However, you know, there are still very intelligent people where the motivation is, unfortunately, a better lifestyle for their family. And that's the motivation for the college and working for several years to get to the point where you can look back at your family and then your children and say, wow, I did good. I provided. They're set.
Right.
And that's the individual motivation that we find in the capitalist society, which, yeah, it creates greed, but it would make something like this utopia just impossible.
I don't know what it would be, but it wouldn't be America, because that's what gears everybody up, is to try to be the best they can be. You know, it sounds like a Marine thing, doesn't it?
No, that's what it is, the can-do attitude. Moving on, two more topics in this one. I'll just relate, and then we'll go on to the last one that I'll lob out for discussion. This one has 15 pages of replies, 23 flags. The thread author is UFO Reality, and the title of his thread is My UFO Meeting with Senior Air Force Personnel. And yes, indeed. No, indeed.
Don't laugh.
No, this is a great thread. This member actually did get a chance to sit down with Air Force people and talk UFOs, and he relates his story right in the thread. Really? He begins... yesterday, Monday, June 23rd, I drove down to Robins Air Force Base here in Georgia. I met with Dr. Steve Butler and about 10 other people to show them my piece of material, which was given to me and taken from a UFO crash near Munster.
Okay, I remember that now. Okay, okay.
Which happened in 1998, and to talk about UFOs. I contacted Dr. Butler about a week ago, and he set this meeting up for me. I was so nervous, I was shaking as I walked into the MERC facility. And just a phenomenal thread. He relates a lot of his stories. A lot of members are rightfully asking some pointed questions and also giving him a great deal of support.
And then also a great deal of him being highly overcritical and not applauding him really for his efforts.
Right. But I want to do that here today because he sat down with people that might have a chance of doing something about what he had. And so he got out there and he did something that's fantastic. I mean,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of members that didn't take him seriously or don't take his story seriously, but that doesn't matter. Here it is. He did something. He went out and he did more than just type about it on the internet, and that's phenomenal.
While we're on this thing, you know, I guarantee you, I mean, we're kind of closet, show me, you know, don't forget what you did for me yesterday, show me what you do today. Rather right. than, okay, well, that's great. We applaud you for going out and trying to at least doing something. Now let me go out and do my. I mean, if every one of us that started a thread and got people gung-ho on whatever, if those people, just 10 of those people, 5 of those people, went out and they did something equally meritorious, I mean, imagine what the world could be today. You know, I mean, that's what just gets me, everybody sitting on their keys.
And I would like to applaud you, Dave Rabbit, because you used a $4 word there.
Which one was that?
Meritorious.
Meritorious? Now, see, I'm practicing my alphabet A through Z, and I was on M today.
That, see, even I knew what Johnny was talking about because that stood out so much.
Yes.
Well, maybe I need to go to Saigon more often. Maybe it's, you know, the stress is less over
yeah,
here.
Bring a lot more dollars in the dictionary.
Well, to round out the topic, I'm sure this one will inspire some excellent conversation as we cover the 6th most popular topic on ATS this week. We have 14 pages of replies. The thread has 45 flags, and it's authored by our favorite senior citizen writer, Grady Philpott, and it's in the news forum. And the title of the thread, and I only really, I'm sure, need to read the title. And then I'll hand it off to either of you two for your take on this bit of news. The court, Supreme Court rules in favor of Second Amendment gun rights.
Yeah, I saw that.
Dave, I'll let you go ahead, you being formerly in the military.
Well, you know, I mean, I've always believed that we should have the right to bear arms, period. You know, I mean, if criminals and you know, all of the bad element of our society can do it illegally, I mean, I see no reason whatsoever that we can't be able to do it legally. So I'm glad they overturned it. I mean, my take is I'm glad they overturned it because, you know, you start doing it in D.C., and then it becomes now they're doing it in Georgia, now they're doing it in Mississippi, and, you know, I mean, if you don't stop that leak in the dike, put your finger there and stop it, then you're going to have a flood. And so I applaud them for overturning
it. Okay, so Dave is in favor of the right to bear arms. Mr. Anonymous, how do you feel?
I'm not going to necessarily say that I'm on the borderline on this one, but I will give you both views of a very disturbed split personality of Johnny Anonymous, and that is this.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Do we get popcorn?
Yeah. Well, on one hand, you know, our forefathers took a lot of time and effort to construct and word very precisely and very carefully our First Amendment rights and also the Constitution of the United States, which slowly but surely, in my opinion, seems to be getting eroded away. Very slowly and very kind of inconspicuously, but still that is happening. I mean, in that sense, I think, you know, they had the foresight to know that later on in life and as history and the future proceeded, that there would probably be occasions that would arise where people in a very strong military or political position may want to try to change, erode, evolve into a different system of things. And what better way to have control over the populace than to remove the one thing that could possibly stop them? Okay, so that's one side of the split personality. The other, on that same side of the split personality side of Johnny, and yes, there are probably many multiple personalities, is that I do think that they should possibly change the laws for gun ownership. And in this instance, I would be leaning towards, if you are going to be owning a gun, I think there should be something more than possibly a page or two of written material for you to fill out with questions like, have you ever suffered a mental disorder or something like that? Well, look, if I had, do you think I'm going to tell you about it? I think they should have something along the lines of where there might be like some type of minor psychology test that somebody has to take before they can own a gun.
But John, you know, let me
jump in here. Well, first, right. Yeah, to that point, I mean, it is generally more difficult to own a car than it is to own a gun in a lot of states in this country.
Exactly.
But I go back to your comments about the founding fathers, and what I see is something that a lot of people forget about this issue of the right to own a gun is they were worried at the time that they put this into the amendments of the Constitution. They were concerned that there could be a tyrannical government,
exactly.
And at some point, like you said, and they wanted to ensure that there was a properly armed militia within the population, and for good reason, and just as you said. But what we're forgetting about now is, you know, that was the original purpose, is the right to bear arms so that we had a properly armed militia in the event the government became tyrannical, so that the people could rise up against and have unfortunate but likely violent change if need be. But that was when both sides had muskets.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The balance of power is very different now. The reason for the properly armed militia in the right to bear arms doesn't apply anymore. And I think I was very frustrated that the Supreme Court didn't attack it from that point of view. Some people were hoping they would, and they completely shied away from it. And I do, you know, I think it's important for anyone who is capable of safely having a firearm should be able to do so in this country. And that there should be better ways to both ensure that those people get them and to properly punish those who don't have properly registered firearms.
And like you say, I mean, there's a hell of a difference between, you know, when we were doing muskets and now you can go out and get an AK-47, you know.
That right. You'll use for duck hunting.
Yeah, yes. Well, I got to have this Sherman tank for pheasant hunting. That's what I got to do.
Yeah,
I want to just completely, unfortunately, change the tone a bit here and cover something that was discovered today that's very sad for a lot of members of ATS. It was confirmed that a longtime member, Schatz, had recently passed away.
Oh, no.
Oh, and, no, really?
Yeah, I know you guys haven't been that active on the site lately. It just came up. And he was on ATS since mid 2004, and
oh,
he was
wow.
A news junkie and posted quite a bit of news, a lot of great threads. He has, if you're looking down his list of threads, you know it's quite common to see most of his threads with multiple pages of replies. Just a
wow.
Great contributor to ATS. It's really sad to see someone like that pass away, and we wish. Here it is. I'm sorry, I didn't recall this from the original post. He had Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh no!
Oh man!
Yeah, and it's
well, our hearts,
it's really sad.
Our hearts and condolences go out to his family and
absolutely.
Survivors.
Absolutely, I'm so sad about this. Really
yeah, he am. Created over 500 threads, 5,000 or 524 threads and over 11,000 posts. I'm sorry.
And
over
I bet every one of them was a class act, too.
Oh, yeah, he was a great member. He really did a good job. You don't last that long on ATS without being someone that knows how to treat other people.
And we don't necessarily want to end it on a sad note, but I'll add that he will live on, and his post will live on here at AboveTopSecret.com, and we encourage you to join us again for the ATS Mix. Bill, we certainly appreciate you taking a little bit out of your busy time to join Dave and I, and we'll hope you'll come back and join us again soon.
Okay, and Dave, tell Bambi I said hello.
I will, but hey, Bambi! Okay, I'll tell her when she gets out of the bathroom.
Okay.
All right, well.
She's been in there all this time?
Yeah, good luck with that fantasy.
Yeah, two 60-year-olds. Boy, that's exciting, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for those nightmares I'll be having tonight.
All right, boss. Well, listen, thanks for joining us. And sorry about the three-way, but hopefully I'll be back in studio next week.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
All right, kids.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Well, Dave, as you know, I am out and about on a little research project that I'm doing in Monterey, California.
Right.
And we had scheduled to do an interview with somebody I wanted to interview when we first did the inception of the ATS Mix. And it just happens to coincide with me being out of town. So through the marvels of technology, I'm on a telephone here in Monterey, California. You're on... in the recording studio there in Dallas, California, or Dallas, Texas, excuse me, and then we have our interview guest in parts unknown somewhere in California.
Right.
And let's tell everybody a little bit about who it is we're going to be interviewing today. Are you ready, Dave?
I'm pumped for this, baby.
The gentleman we're going to be interviewing today is named Colm Kelleher. He's a research scientist and an author. He received his PhD in biochemistry at Trinity College Dublin and has 21 years of experience in the field of cell and molecular biology. In addition, he was an administrator for a Nevada aerospace company, Space Sciences, Inc. He was also the deputy administrator of NIDS, which I believe stands for the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, where he led the investigation at the infamous Skinwalker Ranch. He currently is a senior research scientist working in the biotechnology sector. He has published 38 peer-reviewed scientific papers in molecular biology, immunology, biochemistry, and virology, as well as a number of articles in magazines such as Omni, and has also had the privilege of authoring two books, including Brain Trust, which was released in 2004, and along with George Knapp, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, which was released in 2005. His books are available at Amazon.com, and his website is www.colmkelleher.com, and that is www.colmkelleher.com. And, of course, we also have those links up at our ATS Mix Arena podcast page for our listeners and members alike to be able to click on those links. And it's a great privilege and honor to have with us Dr. Colm Kelleher. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. Good to be with you.
Hey, Colm. Thanks. We really appreciate you taking the time. But, you know, I got to ask you before we get down to the questions. C-O-L-M, I have heard pronounced Colm. So my question is, how many people call you Colm before they realize it's pronounced Colm?
I would say it's about 80% of people. Everywhere where I've worked in North America, it's always started off with Colm and then ended up at Colm. I was actually, when I was in Dublin in high school, there were three people named Colm in my class. So it's a very common name in Ireland, but doesn't seem to have traveled very well over to North America. It's a name that definitely is easily mispronounced, and I've got to the stage where it's Colm what you like.
I like that one. Call them what you like. I love that.
I like it.
Yeah, I do too. Well, listen, you know.
I don't take offense at whatever pronunciation you come up with at all. In fact, I worked in Europe for a while, and some of the pronunciations were pretty creative, I would say.
Yeah, I bet they were.
So hence, call them what you like is fine.
All right, very good. First off, I got to tell you that when I started doing the research, and Johnny and I started doing the research, and we started really finding out about all the things that you were involved with, which just blew me away. The first question, I guess, really is, Colin, how does a highly credentialed scientist such as yourself end up working for a science institute, the National Institute for Discovery Science, known as NIDS, investigating paranormal phenomena and frontier science?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. All the way back in 1996, I was working at a Denver Institute of Immunology, National Jewish Center for Immunology, doing research on viruses and the immune system. And I was flipping through the career ads in Science magazine, which is kind of one of the more common magazines in science. And I came across this really strange ad. It said, we're looking for research managers who are interested in exploring the origin and nature of consciousness in the universe. And this was in the back pages of, like I said, one of the most prestigious journals in the world,
right.
And it stood out like a sore thumb. So I've always been interested in exploring the sidelines in science, and this looked like it could be right up my alley. So I applied and got the job.
Well, now, sir, if I could just ask a quick question here, and I'm sorry to Dave to jump in here, but were you already involved with NIDS before getting approached about the Skinwalker Ranch, or did it come before or after that?
Well, when I moved from Denver to Las Vegas, it was to take up this job with the National Institute for Discovery Science, which was a fledgling scientific organization that was created by Robert Bigelow, who is, apart from being a real estate entrepreneur, he also is CEO of Bigelow Aerospace, an aerospace company in Las Vegas. But his idea was to bring together a whole bunch of credentialed scientists to investigate the anomalies, scientific anomalies, including UFOs. So when I moved there, there was a staff of probably half a dozen scientists and then a scientific advisory board comprising, you know, people from right across North America, you know, in physics, chemistry, biology, medicine, psychology, computer science, forensics. So once the NIDS got going seriously, one of our first cases was this unusual place up in northeastern Utah that we heard about, which later became the Skinwalker Ranch.
Well, let's talk about the Skinwalker Ranch since you've segued in here. How long did the Gormans live on the ranch?
Well, the Gormans moved into Skinwalker Ranch, and it had been previously unoccupied the previous 7 years in late, I believe, 1994. So the ranch, as I said, had been totally empty. It had been owned by a well-to-do family in Salt Lake City for the previous 20 years or so, but it had remained pretty well unoccupied for the previous 7 years before the Gormans moved on. And so late 1994 was when the family, that's the husband, wife, and two teenage kids, moved onto the property. And essentially, it was completely, you know, run down, broken down. There was a homestead on the property, 480-acre ranch.
Right.
And they had to start from scratch, rebuilding, taking, you know, boulders out of the middle of the pastures and this kind of thing, and before they could move their cattle onto the property.
Staying along that line there, and I don't mean to interrupt you, sir, but obviously there has been a long history associated with this area, not just necessarily the Skinwalker Ranch, that there had been something or scenarios and events going on in that area.
Well, we were really fortunate to quickly run into a guy called Junior Hicks. His name is Joseph Hicks, but He started off as a high school teacher in Roosevelt, which is very close to the ranch in Utah, in 1950. And he within sort of a year of him starting in 1950, it became obvious that the entire area was being subjected to, it was the equivalent of Grand Central Station in terms of UFOs flying around the place. And remember, this is a very quiet, rural, very religious Mormon area in Utah.
Right.
There's a Native American reservation, a Ute Native American reservation close by. But Junior Hicks, within a couple of years, became the sort of unofficial documentation person for these activities, and he became trusted by the local people. So he gathered, over the decades, a really intense compendium of every known sighting that had occurred in that area since the early 1950s. And by the time we interviewed him in 1997, he had compiled over 400 primary eyewitness cases from, you know, various families that would never want to go public with any of this stuff. And, you know, he basically threw his files open to us, and we were able to go through all of the details. And the bottom line is the ranch is in the middle of what looks like, as I said, Grand Central Station in northeastern Utah for probably 5 decades at a minimum.
All right. Well, how did NIDS get involved? Did the Gorman family request them, or were they contacted the family themselves?
Well, NIDS had a bunch of field operators that were spread around the western part of the United States in different states. They were doing investigations, and then they would report back to the headquarters in Las Vegas, and if something interesting came up, then the team of scientists would be dispatched to whatever part of the country was necessary to investigate. So one of our investigators kind of picked up this set of rumors, really, that, you know, once we got to the Gorman family, they became much more believable, but rumors of some extraordinary activity that were happening in northeastern Utah. And this we picked up the rumors around, I think, mid-1996. It was in the area around July or so of 1996. And first thing we did, obviously, was we were lucky as an organization to have the availability of a private jet, which not too many science organizations have and not too many organizations that investigate anomalies have.
Right.
But we took a private jet up to Utah, and had a face-to-face with Tom Gorman and his family. And, within the first hour of conversation, became obvious that this family were not sort of flaky, off-the-wall people. They were very sort of down-to-earth and very extremely intelligent. That's one thing that came across very strongly with this family, was how intelligent and obviously hardworking and, you know, these people were not looking for publicity, but what had happened by the time they had talked to us was that their entire, you know, herd of 80 high-end purebred Angus animals had been reduced by about 20% by cattle mutilations and by disappearances, so that economically they were almost out of business.
Wow.
That's just the cattle mutilation part on the ranch. At the same time, on a weekly basis, and the Gorman family, you know, just basically laid everything on the table and just said to us, here's what has happened. And so we interviewed them for, you know, dozens and dozens of hours cumulatively over the next couple of months. And we got a very, very accurate picture of what had transpired between October 1994 and July of 1996, which is when we became involved. And, you know, what had happened to this family essentially was that not only were they terrorized by whatever was conducting cattle mutilations on their property, but they were also terrorized by a whole variety of seemingly bizarre, unconnected UFO sightings, out of world voices, strange creatures on their property, very strange noises, poltergeist activity, evidence of hauntings. It seemed like the entire paranormal book was being sort of flipped open page by page and sort of thrust in these people's faces. When we actually sat down with them, they were sleeping, all four members of the family were sleeping in their living room together on the floor for protection because they really didn't know what was coming at them, you know, the next night.
Oh, wow.
So when we met them, they were at the stage when, A, they wanted to get off the property as quickly as they possibly could, so they sold the property to the National Institutes for Discovery Science, basically to Robert Bigelow, and they moved off the property as quickly as possible. They just didn't want to know about this place anymore. And you know, they were economically in ruins. Their entire herd of cattle had been reduced by 20%. And, you know, normally in the cattle business, a 1% to 2% loss is enough to cause concern. But 20% puts you out of business.
Yeah, and we're talking about cattle that weren't just several hundred dollars. We're talking about cattle that were multiple thousands of dollars each, were we not?
That's right. That's right. These were very high-end Black Angus and Simmental cattle that were essentially show animals and animals that were used in for breeding purposes at the very high end of the cattle spectrum. I mean, we interviewed a lot of ranchers in the area, and this guy Gorman was acknowledged as an expert in, you know, artificial insemination in the area. He was acknowledged as a very, very capable rancher. So the idea that, you know, he would lose, or this family would lose 20% of their cattle was, you know, it was just so off the wall.
Right.
You know.
Well, I know that I was extremely interested when I first caught wind of this, and I believe I probably heard about this first on with Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM when you were being interviewed by him. And I went to the website, and it's at a website. But around 2004, it seemed like everything kind of came to a halt. What was really the reason for that, and is NID ever planning on becoming active again at some stage?
Well, I left NIDS in October of 2004. I moved into more mainstream work in the biotechnology sector. But prior to that, a lot of the people, the senior scientific staff at NIDS, had left to move to other jobs, and it was a combination of many things, but mostly it was because the research, the constant, I suppose, chasing of phantoms, and the book Hunt for the Skinwalker kind of details the different steps over the years that we took, but the accumulation by 2004. It was obvious that we needed to take a breather and essentially, you know, kick back and look at the data in a much more sort of distanced way, because up to that we had been spending hundreds of days per year on the Utah Skinwalker Ranch. And so the staff felt they needed a breather. Also, the management at NIDS decided that a lot of what was going on at the ranch had subsided in the 2002 to 2004 area. So, again, that was an impetus to step back and take a look at the data from a distance. So I still keep in touch with many of the people who were involved at NIDS. But as of now, NIDS is on ice, so to speak, and it can be reactivated at the CEO's, you know, he's the decision maker in that, and he will decide whether or not it will be reactivated. Right now, obviously, Robert Bigelow is focused on his immensely successful company that's involved in space exploration. I mean, right now he has two, maybe three, orbiting platforms.
Now, those are the Genesis projects, right?
Yes, that's right. And so... A lot of the focus after 2004 has really gone to drilling down on expanding the whole aerospace, because NIDS became essentially a research, sort of a covert, semi-covert research arm of the aerospace company, and you know, because of the downgrading in activity, on the Skinwalker Ranch that happened 2002 through 2004, it was decided to put NIDS on ice for the time being.
All right. Well, the question's got to be asked, and of course, Johnny will tell you, I'm the one that's going to ask it. If a group made up of highly intelligent scientists such as yourselves and your collaborators and researchers, if you guys have problems finding physical evidence of paranormal activity, does that mean that the book is closed on this and that there's little chance of ever being able to scientifically prove any of this phenomena?
I don't think so. I think there are, you know, we went through a series where we were a series of probably 3 to 4 years worth of field experimentation, you could call it, on the Skinwalker Ranch. And during that time, we tried a whole number of different ploys. But essentially, we were in a very, very different mode on that ranch from, say, the Gorman family were for the first 2 years of their existence. I mean, they were essentially at the mercy of whatever was on that property at the time. We moved on with a lot of high-tech equipment. You know, we changed the rules of the game very, very strongly. I mean, we had a whole bunch of different equipment there that was designed to really track whatever these phenomena were. We had handheld spectrometers. We had equipment to measure radiation. We had magnetic field detection equipment, electric field detection equipment. So we set up a sort of a command center on that property. So we transformed everything. So whatever was on the property became the hunted, you know, hence the name Hunt for the Skinwalker.
Right.
I mean, we were hunting whatever was on that property in a very aggressive way. So from the moment that began, there was a period, I think we started this whole thing in September of 1996. There was a period between September 1996 and probably early 1998, say, where the intensity was very, very, you know, it was sustained from our perspective. We were hunting every day, and we encountered a lot of very, very weird stuff. After that, there was a definite sort of downgrading in activity, and it was a dial down effect where incidents were happening much less frequently. They were much more transient. They were much more difficult to get at. But during that period, when we were sort of on full steam, whatever was being hunted was very much there on the property, and it had changed somewhat from being extremely visible in your face for the Gorman family to being still extremely visible, but very transient. So we deployed everything we had because we had a scientific advisory board comprised of, you know, multiple scientists from right across academia, from right across the research arm of the government, different departments of the government. So they held our feet to the fire in terms of employing the scientific method. So we were strictly scientific methodology for pretty well the entire time on the Utah Ranch. I think that was definitely a way to go at the time, but I think it brought a lot fewer results than we would have anticipated. And because of that, I think other approaches could be tried, and not least of which would be, say, a backing off so that the hunting aspect would become a lot less visible and a much more long-term, a less visible presence on the ranch might produce better results than what we essentially did, which was we were under the mandate from the Science Advisory Board to get data and to get reproducible data and measurable data. So I think there's a whole bunch of different angles that can be tried on this property before you could say, okay, it's time to cash in our chips. I think the rigorous step-by-step scientific methodology using standard measurement equipment that's always been used for in the UFO field may not be the best way to go in hindsight.
Right.
I want to add a quick sidebar here because I know Dave wants to ask a question here, and I'm sure a lot of members want to hear about some of the experiences out there at the ranch. But just as a quick sidebar, and my apologies, Dave, but do you think that because you weren't able to get exactly perhaps the same type of results as like what the Gormans were experiencing or whomever was probably there before the Gormans, do you think that might lean towards these events and scenarios were possibly feeding off of a negative emotional response from the people that were inhabiting the area at the time?
Well, we certainly looked at that because, you know, this family was a kind of a perfect setup because they were, number one, this ranch is extremely isolated. I mean, we're not talking about right next to Walmart. It's right in the middle of nowhere, and it's a very isolated spot. So the second thing is there were two teenagers in the family. There's a long history, for example, in the literature of poltergeist activity associating itself with teenagers, fluctuating emotions, and all of that. So in many ways, you know, we were looking at the, you know, the psychological aspect of the Gorman family, and they, you know, once they started losing cattle, they started really panicking, and you know, it slowly dawned on them over time, you know, beginning in late 1994 and into early 1995, that, you know, you can explain some of these phenomena as coincidences and what have we, but when the whole sort of intensity and the numbers of these incidents started mounting in early 1995, they came to the conclusion they were dealing with something that was not business as usual. It wasn't sort of the stuff you learn about in school. So, you know, they were getting more and more freaked out as time went on. I mean, at one stage, the wife used to go for these night walks, you know, alone on the ridge,
right,
during the early days when they just moved down to the ranch. Within 4 to 5 months, that whole thing stopped because, you know, things would fly just right over her head. She'd hear the whoosh of large whatever was brushing past her was very large, and she could never see it. I mean, so, you know, gradually her emotional and the whole family's emotions started taking a toll. I mean, they became more and more paranoid. So, you know, you could say you could postulate there was a sort of an emotional feeding frenzy happening on that property before the NIDS group arrived. And once we arrived, we just cut that whole thing in half because we were not in the business of being victims. We were in the business of tracking whatever was on this property with as much equipment as we could lay our hands on. So the entire emotional and all of that, the entire atmosphere on the ranch changed in July, August of 1996.
Well, you know, before we get into some of the experiences, which is what I'm really interested to hear about, I want to tell people that Skinwalker is actually a Native American and Norse legend. In fact, when I was doing some research, it explains a skinwalker is a person with the supernatural ability to turn into any animal he or she desires. Similar creatures can be found in numerous cultural lores all over the world, closely related to beliefs in werewolves. In other words, it's like you're on all fours. And there's several instances where they refer to the Navajo skinwalker. So obviously you guys, when you first got there, Colum, you when you started writing the book, you associated with this because of the experiences that the Gormans were telling you about?
Yeah, the ranch sits very, very close to a fairly large Ute reservation, a Native American reservation, and one of the first things we got in terms of information from our contact, Junior Hicks, this school teacher who had worked there for 50 years, was that, you know, in his interactions with the Ute tribe, they had told him that the ranch was on the path of the skinwalker. Essentially, he said that there was a sort of a migration that happened on whatever, I'm not sure what the regularity was, where a skinwalker or skinwalkers would walk on this path And for whatever motivations or whatever, you know, the Skinwalker legends led it to, but that the ranch was essentially a no-go area for members of the tribe because it was on the path of the Skinwalker. And Skinwalkers were associated with evil. They were associated with black magic. They were associated with a lot of negative stuff that the most members of the Ute tribe didn't want to deal with. So, you know, that had actual sort of real-life consequences for us. For example, if we wanted to have irrigation ditches on the ranch fixed, essentially none of the members of the local Ute people would come anywhere close to the ranch. And, you know, we had to employ people that were more distant, who were usually, you know, not Ute tribespeople, to fix our irrigation ditches or irrigation gates if they went down, that kind of thing. So, you know, there was a very real fear in the area of the Skinwalker, and we could never actually get close enough and intimate enough with the local Ute people in order to get the real deal on what was happening with Skinwalkers. I mean, there was one stage when we brought some of the more friendly Ute tribespeople to Las Vegas, and we talked to them for a while, and then one of them started talking about Skinwalkers, but the other members of the group just said, absolutely no more discussion on that. We don't want to talk about that.
Wow.
So, you know, there was a sort of a blanket policy of refusing to discuss the whole Skinwalker thing. But I mean, the impetus for the title of that book, for example, was because the Skinwalker Ranch was actually on the path of the Skinwalker.
Colin, perhaps you could tell us about some of your own personal experiences that you had there at the Skinwalker Ranch, and maybe what some of these encounters meant to you.
Certainly I can, yeah. As I said, we moved onto the property in about August, July, August of 96. We set up the equipment and really got going by probably September of 1996. And between September and March of 1997, we were parked in the observation trailer. We were out on the property on many occasions. And many, many different times we saw in the distance, usually, what we could term as unidentified flying objects, objects that we knew were not aircraft, we knew were not helicopters, we knew were not, you know, ball lightning or meteors or the usual explanations. They were silently moving, and they moved sometimes at great speed, sometimes they hovered. But really, I think the first real incident that affected me as an individual occurred in March of 1997, when we were just about organizing for the one of these week to 2 week long trips from Las Vegas up to Utah, when we got a call from the ranch manager. This was in March of 1997, and he said that one of the calves on the property had been mutilated, essentially, within about an hour of he and his wife. They had just tagged this newborn calf, about an 84-pound calf. So with that news, we were on our way up there anyway, so we hopped into this private jet, went to the local airport, and drove to the ranch. We were standing over that animal within about 4.5 to 5 hours of the telephone call. So we had a veterinarian with us, a professional veterinarian, who had his bag of tools. And, you know, one of the first things that was obvious looking down at that animal on the pasture was how perfectly the animal had been placed. First thing that we noticed, obviously, was that the animal had been ripped open between its entire abdomen was empty. Its rib cage was essentially jutting into the air. There were no internal organs at all in the animal. There was just the head, the empty abdomen, and the legs kind of splayed out in a sort of a... It looked like the animal had been very carefully laid on the grass. And not a single internal organ, not a drop of blood on the animal, not a drop of blood in the animal. You know, the first naive thought was predator until it became obvious, you know, predators usually leave a lot of mess. And even an 84-pound calf, you know, contains 2.5 liters of blood. So there was not a single drop of blood. And that was probably the spookiest thing. You know, all you could see was this shiny pink flesh that was, you know, absolutely devoid of blood. So the veterinarian, with his bag of tricks, started the equivalent of an autopsy. They call it necropsy in the veterinarian community. So the first thing he noticed was that the ear that usually contains this big, bright yellow tag had been cut off very close to the head, the animal. And from the veterinarian's perspective, even before he took samples to send to the lab, it was pretty obvious that a sharp instrument had been used to cut this ear right off close to the head. It was a very, very sharp cut. There was no signs of a jagged edge, you know, that a sort of tooth marks would leave. It was very, very clean.
Right.
So the veterinarian went through his whole thing, took samples, sent them off to a lab. Subsequently, like two independent labs confirmed that a sharp instrument had been used on this animal. Actually, two different sharp instruments had been used. One was like a machete-type instrument, and another was a very fine scissors-type instrument. But, you know, interviewing the ranch manager, all of this incident had happened in bright daylight. These people had just tagged this newborn calf on the morning at sort of 9:30 or so. And they had walked down the pasture, and they were tagging all of the animals that they, you know, that had been born the previous couple of days with the big, bright yellow ear tags, plastic ear tags. And so they were about 200 yards away, down on the same pasture, when the dog that was with them started freaking out and sort of ran. But it was enough of a commotion that it drew their attention back to where they had tagged this animal, you know, less than an hour or so ago. And so they walked back, and they found the calf, which they had just tagged in bright daylight an hour or so previously. They found the animal just as we found it, you know, all of the internal organs gone. They did not hear a sound. They did not see anything. And this was like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning on a very, very bright day. There was, you know, it was one of the first bright days of the Utah spring, and there was still unmelted snow around the edges of the field. So when we got there, this scene was very, very spooky because it combined, you know, great force had been used to sort of pull this animal down and kill it, and all of the internal organs had been removed. But at the same time, the way the animal was laid on the pasture with this sort of careful, all four legs were perfectly positioned. It was as if, you know, a great deal of care had been laid, had been put into laying the animal out. And we obviously looked carefully for any sign of blood underneath the animal. We even, in the subsequent days, we even went to the local slaughterhouse. We got 2.5 liters of blood, that the amount that could be contained in a calf. We poured it on the ground near where the animal was found, and we videotaped the grass just in case that blood had been sprayed there by a predator and had been absorbed into the soil. Still, 48 hours after doing that experiment, we could still videotape the bright hemoglobin red color on the grass. So there was no possibility that blood had been spilt on the on the grass and had been absorbed by the soil. The bottom line was that this had happened in broad daylight, very close to two people who lived on the property, you know. And, you know, we were living on the property too, so it was, you know, something unseen and unheard had carried out this attack in broad daylight when two people who had very acute hearing and very good eyesight were only a couple of hundred yards away. They didn't see anything. At the same time, you know, it was there was an escalation in the threat level. It was, you know, we took it as a sort of a sign that, you know, whatever was on this property was capable of, you know, intervening physically with great force and also capable of being undetected. So, you know, the threat level on the property definitely went up, and that was the first incident that I felt affected me, you know, to an extent when I saw that that calf lying on the grass.
Well, speaking about affecting you, I'm just curious. There were people living there prior to the seven-year hiatus, if you will, before the Gormans get there.
Right.
So obviously, you know, because of the area that it's at, Indian reservation kind of scenario, has this skinwalker legend, if you will, of the ranch being right there. You know, and then after you guys get there and arrive and do all your research and stuff, I'm just curious, did you ever have any, or any of the members of your team, did you ever have any unexplained side effects because of your experiences and your research there?
You mean personally?
Yeah, personally.
I have not noticed anything. I know that the, you know, during the time that we were on the property, there was a sort of, it was like sort of, entering into sort of, once you get onto the property, we're sort of moving into what you knew was going to be a strange week or 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever long the particular stint was. But
right.
I never felt psychologically affected, or I don't think any of the other members of the NIDS team felt psychologically affected, with one exception, actually. There was one scientist who had this very, very intense interaction down and midway down the property with something that seemed like it was inducing telepathic suggestion in him or something. It never happened to me, but he had nightmares for months afterwards.
Really?
On that. But that was the only real, you know, after effect, so to speak, of much of what the research was. Because, you know, when you have a mindset of you're trying to track something, and you're trying to get as much physical evidence, because remember, we had briefings every couple of months when the Science Advisory Board would fly in from around the country, and they would essentially grill us for 2 days, you know, every couple of months on the progress and on the deadlines and what had been achieved and how it had been achieved. So we were under the gun to focus on collecting scientific evidence. So even though there was, you know, a calf had been obviously gruesomely killed in broad daylight, our primary focus was on gathering the evidence to that effect. And in, you know, the upshot of this whole thing was that the veterinarian did a very good job of doing the necropsy, sampling the tissues appropriately, and getting the lab analysis done to the extent that two independent labs confirmed that sharp instruments had been used on this animal, and, you know, that this was not a sort of, this was not some sort of paranormal event that you know, that was unexplained. I mean, the perpetrators were unexplained, but the modus operandi, we got a good fix on. So physical evidence-wise, that was good, but most of our focus was on, you know, getting any unusual tracks. You know, we would take casts of the tracks, and you know, we were constantly deploying instrumentation, magnetic field detectors, and that kind of thing around the property. So the focus was really on the research as opposed to, you know, gee whiz phenomenology.
Right. I love that one, the gee whiz phenomenology. I love that.
And, you know, speaking of gee whiz, where did the time go? Here we're getting into the good stuff, and we're up to about the end of our time limit with you, Dr. Kelleher. Is it possible that we can have you come back and you can fill us in with some more information?
Oh, I'd love to. Absolutely, yeah. I'd be happy to, because, like you said, we've just scratched the surface on the Skinwalker saga. I mean, there's a lot more to tell, for sure.
And there's a lot more. Yeah, and there's a lot more questions. Well, before we let you go, Cullum, we want to remind everybody about the two websites, Brain Trust, which is www.CullumKelleher.com. That's CullumKelleher.com. And then, of course, the magnificent Skinwalker, Hunt for the Skinwalker website, which is www.HuntForTheSkinWalker.com. And they can also get the book through that site, can they not?
Yes, they can. They can buy it on that website via Amazon.com or Powell's or any of the book distributors.
All right. Well, Colm, listen, we really appreciate your time, and we will hook up with you. If you don't mind, we'll hook up with you again next week, bring you back on for part two. I know everybody's chomping at the bits to hear more of what's going on at the Skinwalker Ranch.
Thank you very much.
On behalf of myself, Dave Rabbit,
and Johnny Anonymous,
somewhere out in Monterey, California, sipping the wine country, we'll see you next time on the ATS Mix.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll